that they've done genetic engineering. The BC Cotton was, this is what the our government agency that's supposed to be in charge of genetic engineering approval said. The crop which is standing may pass to the soil that modified genes which it contains. The effect on soil microorganisms cannot be estimated and may cause an irreversible change in the environment structure. It is a standard practice to uproot the crops and then the government audit uprooting and burning the entire crop of 10,000 acres. Our own feeling is that this was partly done because at that point India had not changed its patent laws. And Monsanto could not use this to claim ownership over this crop. So they were more than happy to push for its destruction so that at that point the pollution did not end up becoming their property. But now, at this, now our patent laws are changed. And the only change that has been made in May last year is a change that allows patenting on genetically engineered seeds. There's no monopoly patents on medicine yet, no other change, only on genetically engineered seeds. Just a few delicate clauses here and there, but you add it up and you know it's a Monsanto amendment is what I've called it. So yes, they did definitely wherever they can, because they want a sense of hopelessness that you have no choice, you know. They want through pollution the idea spread that you have no choice. And that's precisely the mindset we have to avoid. We have to fight pollution. But we also have to stop feeling crippled because contamination has happened. We need to still, you know, I call it, you know, there are two notions of purity. There's a Brahmanical notion of purity, of untouchability, and there's the reasonable notion of purity, where you want to be pure, but you don't feel you're dead if somehow untouchability reached you. And I think we just need to be pragmatic. I mean, we need to keep fighting pollution. We need to keep making the companies accountable. And we need to keep fighting for the, you know, the one unsettled issue is the issue of liability. You know, the polluter pays principle in the case of genetic pollution. We've organized about four different events over the last year, including one just done in January with the victims of the Bhopal disaster. Yeah, it's 18 years because liability was never institutionalized. The 3,000 people then and 30,000 people since then who've lost their lives because of that one disaster. To us continue to be part of the, you know, the costs that are being generated by an industry that is the chemical industry and the biotech industry. So we joined the Bhopal issue because now Union Carbide is bought up by Dow, and Dow is among the big biotech players. And recently at the Asian Social Forum, we did a session called Beyond Bhopal and BT, Towards a Safe Future. And liability, of course, is the key issue. We need to keep, you know, I remember one of my favorite quotations is Kundera's, you know, the struggle of people against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. And I think for each new challenge we face, we need to bring all our past reserves of resistance to bear on it. Because no issue is a totally new issue. They carry all the past conflicts. And we're really up against one industry, which is the chemical industry, which we don't want for organic. The biotech industry, we don't want for organic. It's the same guys who are selling hazardous drugs and wanting patents on medicine and selling medicines at 100 times the price that those medicines could be made. So they're killing us through food, and they're killing us through health, and they're killing us through toxics, and it's totally unnecessary. The health people were very, very smart at organizing around the issue of AIDS drugs. And in 6 months, they created a global campaign to make these companies go totally defensive on the patenting issue and in the WTO TRIPS debate. And I think, you know, my own reading of it is because we in the organic movement love localization so much, what happens is we try and become localized in our politics also. Yeah? I think we need local farming and global politics. That's when we'll make the breakthroughs.
Yes, I'd just like to invite everybody to a movie that's going to be shown here at 3:15 at the Manzanita living room. And in that, I went around the world's biggest farm show, which is, if you don't know, in Tulare, California. It just surpassed Paris, and as the world's biggest farm show is now in Tulare. And I interviewed both Monsanto and Dow, who have genetically engineered seed, and asked them a lot of the questions. So if you want to see a face of Monsanto behind the discussion, and of Dow, the scientist and the salesman, I'd encourage you to watch the film, if you can make it. It's again at 3:15 at the Manzanita living room. Thanks.
I have a fairly simple question, which is, why or when would it be possible for the United States Department of Agriculture to sponsor organic food distribution as part of humanitarian aid assistance worldwide? And also, kind of as a corollary of that, is it more important to export food aid that's organic, or is it more important to export knowledge about how to develop sustainable farming practices worldwide?
You know, one of the things that every human community anywhere in the world knew how to do is to do sustainable farming. Most places where there's hunger is where they were, by one, for one reason or the other, made to stop those practices or prevent it from having those practices. India is such a clear case. There's two volumes of what we call the Ecological Food Atlas of India. It's a history of food and farming from the beginning of Indian recorded civilization to colonial times, and it's very, very clear. Every time we've had famines is when policies prevented farmers from feeding themselves. In the colonial times, it was because they extracted too much surplus. And our big movement at that time, which became part of our freedom movement, was for farmers to say, we need to keep enough to eat. Because 2 million people died in Bengal of a famine created by trade, where more exports of rice were happening to feed the war, and the people who'd grown that rice were starving to death. We got out of it, and the normal story you're told is the Green Revolution got us out of it. No, we got out of it because policies changed to defend the small farmer. We institutionalized land reform. No one could have giant-sized land holdings. Tillers became owners. The land to the tiller policy was implemented rigorously. Irrigation systems were supported. Public systems that support agriculture were put in place. Market systems to create, you know, guaranteed markets, just prices, a universal food distribution, public food distribution, all that was put in place. Farmers started to do well, the country started to feed itself. And then again, globalization is trying to bring back the same policies that created the famines of 1942. And we started to have the beginnings of hunger and starvation deaths emerge. Just done a hearing, I've just completed a hearing, public hearing, and I had a government commissioner come to report that in the regions which he governs, the deaths of infants between the 0 to 6 age group, which used to be caused because of lack of food, was zero at the beginning of the globalization period, which is 91. And today it's 47%. 47% infants are dying of lack of food today, when none of them were dying for lack of food. They died because of other reasons for lack of food, just in a decade. So I don't think, I want to have the 5 minutes that it would take me to do a calculation that if the world's agriculture was crippled and everyone had to depend on U.S. industrial agriculture, there just wouldn't be enough food in the world at all. There'd be massive scarcity. The assumption is no Chinese farmer should grow food for China. The assumption is no Indian farmer should grow food for India. The assumption is also no African farmer should grow food for Africa. You add it all, you know, not organic, not industrial farming in this country would feed the world. So we need to be sure that the food systems, and that's why we talk of food sovereignty, that the food systems of each region are made as resilient as possible. But meantime, while the crisis is there, I would say let's have a campaign on organic fooding. It's all right. I think it's worth it because I really believe that transition arrangements are fine, you know. And very often in movements, it's again that Brahminical notion of purity. Yeah? We want to go there, but we are here. And we insist that unless you can have the pure form of being there, you won't even step there. You know, the road has a bit of this and that. We've got to deal with it, this and that.
One of the legs on which this whole attack is standing on are intellectual property rights. And not only the patenting of life, but the continued repatenting of the different technologies. And we just recently in this country had a 20-year extension to the copyright law. Now, that's not directly related to patents, but it is a part of a strategy for corporations to extend into perpetuity their control over any number of what otherwise would be public domain technologies, ideas, images. I'd like you to speak a little bit to how it might work in countries outside the United States that these rights would be assailed and returned to the public domain.
Well, you know, my involvement with issues of WTO and globalization really started because of the issue of intellectual property. I started to read the Dunkel, it used to be called the Dunkel draft text, you know, this way back, 91, the Uruguay round had been completed, and the director general of the GATT at that time was a person called Arthur Dunkel. And one phrase that is very common in these dictatorial agencies is, they prepare a text, they say this is a democratic decision of member countries, but the secretariat prepares a text, and they call it a take-it-or-leave-it text. You see? Yeah? You've got to sign on it without any change. And when this text was brought to India, it wasn't brought to India democratically. So, you know, some of us managed to get copies through our negotiators. And we called it DDT, the Dunkel draft text. And we encouraged our farmers to start treating it just like DDT. It's a very, very toxic document and a very toxic treaty. And since that time, in 91, we organized rallies. We had 500,000 peasants out on the street. Because when we laid out to them what this treaty involved, that it would allow patenting on life, it would allow monopolies on seed, there's not a single person in India who accepted. So we started to say then that we will do with these laws, if they ever come into force, what Gandhi did with the salt laws of the British. So we started the notion of a Bij Satyagraha. Bij means seed. And its roots are in Ja is life, and Bija is that which from which life arises again and again and again. That's the definition of seed. That's why to us, terminator seed is not seed anymore. It doesn't qualify for seed. The seed should regenerate. Seed, by definition, should reproduce on its own terms. And our Bij Satyagraha is basically a preparation to not cooperate. Navdanya, the movement I started, the ninth, you know, called Nine Seeds, which is basically to save seeds, but it's a political movement from the day we started it. Every member who joins Navdanya, every farmer signs a pledge saying, I will save this seed and I will save it as common property and I will save it in the public domain and I will never ever obey a law that turns it into private property. I will never ever be made fearful for sharing and saving seeds. We do that literally day in and day out in our work. And I at least pledge to myself that we will not let a Percy Spicer case happen in our country. We've already declared non-cooperation. 10 years of non-cooperation. And And the government has had to, in every law, add a clause. The farmers' rights will never be touched. They've had to add those clauses. So when the companies will bring those cases, those other clauses will come into play. So because we had 10-year movements, the governments could not just say absolute monopolies on seed. But I personally feel it's not just third world countries. I think around the world, we need to have a very, very strong reclaiming of the commons and the public good and the public domain, whether it's in software or it's in knowledge or seeds. And I would encourage all of you to keep in touch with the International Forum on Globalization as it prepares for Cancun, because the incomplete agenda on the review of TRIPS, the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights Agreement, it's constantly being brushed under the rug, and all kinds of diversions are, last year they made the world forget about plants and seeds and talked only about medicine, and then they've got stuck with the definition of what will be counted as an epidemic, and the US wants to say only AIDS, and other countries say any public health emergency. But the issue is, it's not just about medicine, it is about every domain of public knowledge. And the Cancun meeting is literally south of you, it's in Mexico. I think this is the year of agriculture, this is the year of reclaiming the commons, and there's lots of work ahead of us.
Thank you. Out of respect for Vandana, and because she's very tired, she just got here after traveling for quite a while, we're probably going to cut this a little short, so we'll take one more question, and then we're going to sequester her somewhere quiet. There will be a brief press conference after this for the press in Stuckups, and if you don't know where that is, you can find someone around here that does. And one more question, and we'll see where this goes.
Yeah, from reading reports that come from India and some of your writings, I am so impressed by the level of organization that I see of the Indian people and that nonprofits and organizations are doing there. Are there any lessons that you can offer people in our country for how to organize a movement that will achieve some of these goals?
You've asked me a very difficult question, because it's very difficult to come from outside anywhere and say, this is what you should do. I'm with you whatever you do.
Okay, thank you. And this isn't the last you're going to be seeing of Vandana Shiva at this conference. She'll be giving the closing plenary tomorrow. So, I'm not sure what to do. We have a lot of very interested people here in GMOs. I am going to...